Today on the 21st, a look back at 1 year since Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. Many Puerto Ricans believe their status as a territory meant they were treated differently. Here's Governor Ricardo Rossello on CBS News.
The truth of the matter is that that unequal treatment has been in Puerto Rico for over a century. We are a colonial territory of the United States.
We'll hear from Puerto Ricans in Chicago and get an update from NPR's Lewis Clemens. And as Jewish people get ready for the holy day of Yom Kippur, today we talk about forgiveness, atonement, and how to reconcile with America's racist past and present. Here's rabbi and Jewish scholar Abraham Joshua Heschel speaking about this very thing in 1963.
The Exodus began, but is far from having been completed. In fact, it was easier for the children of Israel to cross the Red Sea than for a Negro to cross certain university campuses.
That audio courtesy of On Being, that's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. As the southern U.S. continues to deal with Hurricane Florence, we wanted to take a look back on the past year. It's been a year since Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. If you recall, large parts of the island were without power for months. In fact, it wasn't until last month that electricity was restored to nearly the entire island. Many fled for the U.S. mainland. Unfortunately, thousands lost their lives. The official number is now just under 3,000 fatalities. Many of the Puerto Rican residents who left came to Illinois, specifically to Chicago. In a few minutes, we're going to be speaking with the co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda. That's a group of Chicago organizations who have been helping. We'll also hear from a resident who had to flee the island and initially did come to Chicago. But first, I want to welcome Luis Clemens. He's supervising editor of NPR's National Desk and joins us from Washington. Hi, Luis. Welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Good morning, and it's good to chat with you.
Luis, you've been working with reporters on the ground in Puerto Rico, and there's a lot to get to from this past year, whether it's the death toll that we mentioned earlier or the need for electricity. But I thought I should maybe start with what may not be such a simple question. Has the island recovered from Maria a year later?
No, I mean, not completely. No, this is going to be a years-long process, 3 to 5 years before things are close to being what they were like before the storm. I mean, the degree of the disruption in terms of people moving from one place to another, from San Juan to Chicago, as you were talking about, the degree of destruction, physical destruction, roads, the electric infrastructure, water utilities, you name it. It's going to take a few more years before we can say that Puerto Rico has recovered to the point it was before the storm.
And when we're thinking about the infrastructure, particularly when we're thinking about water and electricity, we've heard a lot of reporting about electricity and the grid. How much of that is still a problem throughout the island?
So federal regulations allow for things to be built back to where they were before. So in other words, a damaged pylon gets replaced in the same place, in the same conditions as before. That doesn't necessarily address the underlying problems. But right now, we have a fully functioning grid, and hopefully we'll get through the rest of the hurricane season without a direct hit on the island.
Right, that's a whole other worry. We're speaking with Luis Clemens. He is a supervising editor with NPR's National Desk. One of his reporters he's been working with very closely, NPR's Adrian Florido, has been living in Puerto Rico and will be there for the rest of 2018. With the reporting you're hearing from Adrian, as well as others that NPR has on the ground, how has the recovery effort gone? How is it different, for example, in San Juan versus the more remote or rural areas?
So it is very different. Look, obviously San Juan was the immediate focus in terms of getting power back, getting cell phone service back. It's where you have the largest concentration of people, so it's easiest to make progress. When you get to a town along the Central Mountain Range that is isolated, things move much more slowly. As you said, really, the last few households to get connections back, electric connections back, was only last month. That's an incredibly long period to go through without having access to electricity.
I mean, 11 months. And I think there's also, I wonder how much this plays into the issue of fatalities and then the official death toll. For a while, the number from Puerto Rico's government was just 64. Last month, George Washington University released results from an independent study commissioned by the governor that put the total closer to 3,000. Luis, do we know whether most of these deaths came afterwards in the aftermath when there was so much more help required for the island?
So we have a clear sense that there were only a fraction of those deaths that occurred in the 1, 2, 3 days following the storm or during the storm. This was a real slow-moving train wreck, and we're talking about people dying because they didn't have access to medical care, weren't necessarily able to get the kinds of medical treatments that they would normally. It is often incredibly stressful to live through this and then to wake up and not have power, not have running water, find yourself isolated. So yes, the bulk of the day of the deaths that have been cited were well after the storm had passed. And we're seeing this now also in Florence, where that death toll continues to mount, but that's because of flooding caused by rainfall well after the hurricane passed through.
And I just can't think of how hard that must be. As someone who's lived through lots of hurricanes and dealing with just a week, normally in Miami you have a week, 2 weeks of power, and that in itself is really difficult. The idea of having months or almost a year. When we think about the federal government's response, Luis, Puerto Rico's governor, Ricardo Rossello, has said directly he thinks there's a big difference between the way states like Florida and Texas have been helped versus the way Puerto Rico was helped. What do we know about how accurate that statement is?
So we have a couple things that we have to take into account. I mean, first off, Maria followed Hurricane Irma, which also hit Puerto Rico and knocked out its electric grid, but caused a lot of damage in Florida. And that, in turn, followed Hurricane Harvey that really produced a horrendous amount of damage in Houston. It also hit the U.S. Virgin Islands. I think, as you know, the agency itself has reviewed its response, they've made clear that they weren't fully prepared to take on three hurricanes of this size in rapid succession. When this storm hit, many of the emergency relief supplies that had been prepositioned in Puerto Rico had been sent elsewhere. And when you talk about electricity, I mean, everywhere else in the mainland United States, you talked about power being restored in a week after hurricane in Miami. You'd see trucks pouring in from Tennessee, from Kentucky, from Oklahoma. They can just, those linemen
can just drive
start
down.
Driving.
Mm-hmm.
But the response in terms of inviting or arranging for utility linemen from the mainland to get to Puerto Rico, that was just botched. It was slow. It was overly expensive. But admittedly, it was complicated by the fact that Puerto Rico is an island, and you can't just drive those utility trucks down and start working on the lines the moment the weather clears.
Luis, when we look at the federal government, when we think about FEMA, I wonder what, now that we're a year out from this, we just had another tropical, we had Hurricane Florence last weekend. Certainly, the succession of storms varies according to year, but this problem is not going away. And the idea of multiple storms in a year has been around for more than a decade now. So what are we hearing from the federal government about how they're better preparing for this?
So they've talked about adding, bulking up in terms of both staffing and resources. And in Florence right now, it's just a little too early to tell, to judge their response. I mean, we are still dealing with, in a place like Fayetteville alone, dozens of people being rescued by boat from their homes just yesterday. So we are still very much in the thick of the emergency immediate response. FEMA traditionally comes in when those waters have subsided and start trying to help people out.
Luis, one last question for you. As we think about, I started this conversation mentioning how many people have left the island. As we think about how different this is from other storms, certainly America is a country where people migrate. But again, when we're talking about Puerto Rico, it is an island. So when we think about the numbers of people who left, I wonder how permanent that will be and also what kind of long-term effects you think that will have on Puerto Rico.
So this shrinking of the population, we've seen this in Detroit and other places, has profound effects on the quality of life and the way the society as a whole functions. You have fewer people, that means you have fewer children, which means schools get consolidated, and that's a painful process. You have fewer people, that means fewer people working and generating taxes and generating revenue to try and expand and invest on the island. It just has an incredible series of knock-on effects. And Puerto Rico had already been suffering from a steady outward migration from the island to the mainland. It is an existential question, and this issue of should I stay or should I go gets answered on an individual basis, but affects the entire island dramatically.
That's NPR's Luis Clemens. I wanted to bring another voice into this conversation. Richard Santiago was a resident of Puerto Rico until he left for Chicago because of the storm. He actually recently moved again, this time to West Palm Beach, Florida. Richard, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
I wanted to ask you, Richard, about your life before Hurricane Maria made landfall. Where were you living and working?
I was living in Old San Juan. I was working at the School of Visual Arts and Design in Puerto Rico. It's the only autonomous university that deals with art in the Caribbean, a very important institution. And my kids were actually going to school in maybe like 10 minutes away. It was a pretty easy lifestyle in that sense that everything was kind of set up around them, obviously, and their education and everything. And I was dealing with art. So everything was flowing up until that point, you know.
And where were you in San Juan then when Maria made landfall?
Yeah. We were in our apartment in Old San Juan. And we went through the hurricane in the boys' room because it was the most secure room. And during that process, we lost that apartment. The ceiling came down, so not in the outside of that room. And then also my studio, my equipment, all my art materials, art that I had done for a few years, everything was destroyed. My studio was in Bayamón. And pretty much it was kind of like a restart, you know. Everything was lost, so we had to pretty much, try to survive with the little we had.
I'm so sorry to hear that. When did you realize that, at what point did you decide, I have to leave the island?
Well, those following day, you know what, actually, even through the process of the hurricane, even at that moment when, fear started striking.
Oh, and you hear the wind, it's terrible, right?
Well, everything, the whole process, I started hearing how strong it was and where it was going to go in, because in Puerto Rico, up until the last minute, you're always thinking it's not going to hit, it's going to go away, it's going to turn to the side, it's going to go north, or it's going to go south. So, when you start hearing that it's 140 some miles an hour, it's 150, and it's going right through, and it's going to go right through the whole island, then right there and then you're like, okay, this is replanning everything. Let's get through this, and then let's see what happens. So what happens is that you go day by day. Everything was shut down. There was no ATMs, there was no electrical phone, there was no cellular phones working, there was no electricity, everything that you've heard. So it's like the day after tomorrow, one of those things. But the main thing is that the first responders at that point in time really is the community around you, is the neighbors, is the people that you surround yourself with, and you start reaching out to them, and your circle starts getting a little bigger, you start going a little further away. Roads start getting cleared by the people themselves, so you go a little further, and then you're able to visit your mother, who's like in the next town, your friends, and you try to help them. So in that process of trying to help in the next following days, the people around you, and try to help yourself also, because there's no banks open. You have $40 in your pocket, and you have to survive with that. You have Lipton soup at home, and you're trying to feed your children. I have two kids. One of them was 6, the other one was 7. So, trying to make everything easier for them. And at that point in time, you're just saying, I don't know what's going to happen with the school for them. I don't know how things are going to be. Life is going to be here for the next few months. So then you start making that decision of, what are you going to do?
Richard, why did you decide Chicago?
Well, the thing is, that past summer, I had been there working on some murals. I'm an artist. And And the Puerto Rican Cultural Center and I had come to the idea that later that year or the following year, I would go back to work on a child development center's murals that were going to be done. And they wanted me to do it. So we had settled that that was something that was going to happen next. And so everything kind of, you know, after the storm, everything kind of like moved forward. They were like, you know, come here, you know, we can get you working on that. You know, it was kind of like a sure thing because the university was destroyed. You know, I mean, there was so much damage done to that school. And, you know, I was able to get my kids out to Port St. Lucie where my in-laws are, maybe it was like 20 days after the hurricane. And, you know, during those 20 days, the process of, you know, mosquitoes, you know, that's like I would wake up and see the bed where they were sleeping and there was like little spots of blood everywhere because they were getting bitten by mosquitoes. So, you know, just start worrying about many different things that makes you make a prompt decision of what you have to do. And then, you know, this opportunity came where I could do that work in late October. So I was able to get them out nearly 3 weeks after the hurricane. And then I was able to get out about 5 weeks after the hurricane, you know, and then I was able to get them to Chicago Christmas Day. So, you know, it was kind of like a whole process. You know, at that point in time, I'm the type of person who likes to plan out everything, you know, and have everything set up, Virgo. But you can't plan out, you know, you kind of like have to go with the flow. You have to be patient and you have to try to decide to make the best decision possible for the family at that point in time, you know. Now, if the kids weren't here, I mean, if my wife and I didn't have any kids, I'm pretty sure that we'd be there, you know,
and you would have stayed
doing what we have to do.
Richard, can I stop you for a moment because we need to take a break? I do want to pick up this conversation. If you'll hang with me for a minute here after this short break, we'll continue this conversation with Richard Santiago. We've also been speaking with NPR's Luis Clemens after the break as well. Cristina Pasione Zayas is going to join us as well as we're talking about Maria a year later.
Support for the 21st comes from the Center for Advanced Study, presenting the experimental films of Rene Baker on Saturday, September 22nd at 2 p.m. at the Pennsylvania Avenue Residence Hall. Baker will present her films and discuss the creative process in producing these works. More at cas.illinois.edu.
You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. A year ago this week, Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. And as we look back on the past year and the lives lost, we're also talking about the lives that have been changed, not just on the island, but for folks here in Illinois, particularly in the Chicago area. Right now, I'm speaking with Richard Santiago. He's actually on the line from Florida, which was his second place he moved to after he left San Juan, as he's been sharing his story. He's an artist. Richard, as you talk about your art, as you mentioned, you went to Chicago, you were working on a mural, you've showed one of your installations both in Chicago and now in Florida. It's called The Frailty of Strength. I wonder if you can tell us more about how this has changed your art going through this experience.
Oh, my God. Well, my art has forever changed. And I don't think anybody who went through this process, their art must not have. I mean, whoever hasn't changed somewhere, something didn't click, you know, about the whole thing about art, you know, then I don't know where they were at, you know. Let me explain the fact that as soon as I got to Chicago, I was introduced to the people of the Puerto Rican agenda. And I know that Cristina Bascione is going to come on. She's going to talk about the work, the amazing work that they've been doing. I was introduced to these people who, I got to be really honest, the last thing I was thinking about when I left was to paint. You know, I was thinking about relief efforts. I was thinking about how to help fellow artists in Puerto Rico, the university that was destroyed, family members, friends. So, you know, mainly it was about relief efforts, you know, and the whole process of displacement brought so many issues up on the table about, are you a refugee? Are you an evacuee? You know, how to label that regarding politics and regarding global warming, you know, so there were so many conversations going on. And I guess there's two paths that you could take. You could take the path of leaving and not looking back and, you know, just forging your own life, or you can go some, you know, leave and then always be linked to the possibility of helping the people that are still in the island struggling, you know, and that was my point here, you know. So I thought it would be kind of hypocritical to paint anything that had to do with the misery that we had gone through, or the misery that people were still going through, or the misery that we as displaced people were going through. I think anything that I could have done at that point in time would be kind of like a caricature of that misery. And that's not me, and that's not what I think art is about, you know? So I really started conceptualizing the possibility of working on something that really made sense, you know? So when I heard about this night, if the government came out, the government of Puerto Rico came out maybe a month after the hurricane. So I was touching ground in Chicago, and I heard this news that they said that they had cremated 911 people, and these people are still anonymous. I mean, we don't know who they were. They don't have the information for these people. They didn't go through the right process of identification before cremating, because they couldn't. I mean, the weeks following the hurricane, everything was destroyed. So all these dead people were getting, and even people were burying, you know, family members in their backyard. I remember about that when the dam broke at a certain point in time, there were bodies that were going underwater, you know, and people never saw them again, you know. So that these images of the dead, you know, just kept on getting thought about in my head, you know, and I'm like, what? 911 people cremated. They were not answering the questions, you know, the government. And I decided that if I was going to do something, I had to do something about that, about raising awareness and about manifesting the lives of these 911 people. And, I did conceptualize this installation. It's called The Frailty of Strength and Vice Versa. And it has to do with that. It's a collaborative piece, and it's a piece where people reach out to me, and they let me, in a sense, borrow names of dead that they have, you know, their parents or a loved one that is not with them anymore. And they're letting me borrow their identity to provide an identity to these people who are anonymous, you know. So when they do that, there's a monotype. I work on monotypes, so it's an installation of 911 monotypes, which is a form of graphic art. Now, these pieces, if it was a monotype before the hurricane, it would be sold on my end around $200, $300. I'm selling them for $15 to try to get this 911-piece installation finished. When it's done, part of that money is going to go to the Center of Investigative Journalism, who have been they have done a mammoth-sized job, a beautiful job in confronting.
Because you want to support the work that they're doing as well, Richard.
Yes, absolutely.
Richard,
I mean, they actually sued the government. Yeah.
Yeah. So, as we think about all of this, and I know there's so much of what you've gone through, I wanted to bring someone else into this conversation as well. You mentioned Christina Pasione Zayas. She's co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda in Chicago. And throughout the year, we've been checking in with her about her relief efforts. Christina, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with us as well.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Christina, as you're listening to Richard share his story and share his process, I just want to ask you what the past year has been like for you personally as well.
The past year, I would have to say, has been exhilarating and exhausting. It's been very intense. There have been some very low points in terms of knowing how mistreated Puerto Ricans have been and how the continued silencing of our legacy and our existence persists. But I think what's been exhilarating about it is the resilience of our people and the generosity of those who are in solidarity with us to really demonstrate our capacity to, you know, overcome and to come together collectively to address these chronic issues that have faced our people for centuries.
And when to that point about the chronic issues, as I've mentioned, Puerto Rico's Governor Ricardo Rossello has been telling news outlets about the discrepancy he feels like between the way states like Florida and Texas were treated after their natural disasters, the way Puerto Rico's recovery was handled. Do you feel that way? Do you think many of the Puerto Rican residents of Chicago you work with feel that way?
Absolutely. There has been a very clear distinct difference. But unfortunately, this is nothing new. There's always been a pattern of treating Puerto Ricans as second-class citizens. This comes out of the roots of colonialism and white supremacy, which has been a system of oppression to make sure that, you know, some populations are valued over others. And this is just a really clear public front-facing example of how that plays out. The added benefit, although we've had such massive loss, is that now there can't be any kind of negation that there has been a distinction in treatment, distribution of resources. It really is just an opportunity to illuminate that this is an ongoing issue.
Richard, do you feel that way?
I absolutely feel that way. Not only that, but I would have to add, when I said before, the first responders were the communities and the people who, the neighbors, you know, I mean, FEMA got there weeks later and they do a very inept job. But the following responders were the diaspora. And this is where people like Cristina Bascioni comes in. I mean, they came in with so much help from the Puerto Rican agenda, for example. I think they had the first plane to land in Puerto Rico from the United States and with help, you know, with aid, with relief efforts, you know. And my personal experience, I am forever, and my family is forever grateful to Cristina, because my children went through a traumatic process. And they're still going through a traumatic process. And if it wasn't for her, she actually got us a possibility to get treatment for that trauma from the Erickson Institute. And she did an amazing job with my family. And we went through, you know, thanks to her, my children were able to surpass certain traumas from the hurricane. So, you know, I am an example of what she's saying.
Cristina, to Richard's point about, you brought this up before, the need for mental health treatment. Obviously, this is a very traumatic event, as we're hearing Richard discuss this. Richard, your kids are so young, 6 and 7, right?
Yeah.
Cristina, do you feel like that in Chicago is a need that's being addressed?
There's more need for that. I mean, I think what was, you know, sort of a signature piece of what Richard's talking about with the diaspora is that we wanted to access every single resource that was available and connect it to our community locally as well as those on the island. And so there was no stone not unturned in terms of this whole process. As Richard mentioned, we were the first community to get a flight out of Chicago into the island, and full of emergency supplies in the distribution chain 5 days after the hurricane hit. We did that 4 more times. And from there, we fundraised, and every single dollar we raised went back to the island through micro grants that were basically community leaders rebuilding but needing some money and some resources to do as such. And
Cristina, are you still doing that? Are you still fundraising?
Yes, we are still fundraising. We have raised over $400,000. We have been able to distribute over 35 towns have received micro grants, and currently we're in this rebuilding phase with our campaign called 3 R's for PR, Rescue, Relief, Rebuild. We've adopted 2 towns, Comerio and Luisa, to do some sustainable construction as well as some social cohesion programming around mental health and wellness. And then locally here in Chicago, we've teamed up with different service providers to provide interventions for those that are still, you know, processing the experience of being displaced and what that means. And so at Erickson Institute, my daytime job as policy director, we have a Center for Children and Families that provides mental and behavioral services for young children age 8 and under, and we were able to sync up with the city of Chicago to provide this resource to our recently displaced families from Puerto Rico.
I'm speaking with Cristina Bascioni Zayas. She's co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda. Richard Santiago is on the line with us from Florida. He was a resident of Puerto Rico. He was in Chicago. Now he's in Florida. Cristina, when we think about this, I wonder, when we're thinking about the size of the diaspora in Chicago, how many people do you have a sense of are Puerto Ricans who have moved from the island to Chicago over the past year?
Well, when we established the Hurricane Resource Center in the heart of the Puerto Rican community in Chicago Humboldt Park at the field house through the Chicago Park District, the mayor's office and the alderman's office, we recorded over 2,000 individuals that went through the resource center from November of 2017 through May of 2018. That is not obviously the total amount of individuals that have come to Chicago or Illinois per se, but at least we have a sense. Unfortunately, I mean, Richard is, you know, a case in point, is that in some cases, people have come and they have come temporarily, and in other cases, they remain permanently. Housing continues to be an issue here in Chicago, and so a lot of the families that came had trouble finding affordable housing, housing in communities in which they felt comfortable. We really tried to advocate to open up housing opportunities in the Humboldt Park area where the majority of Puerto Ricans live. And so that we could wrap around with the social services and provide an experience that was a little bit more aligned with their cultural identity.
We just have a minute or two left. Richard, so are you permanently in Florida now?
I am here doing an artist residency. I was actually accepted in at the Armory Arts Center, where the frailty of strength is right now being exposed. I will be going to New Jersey, to Rutgers University, to bring the show, and also Connecticut College. After that, I'll be visiting Puerto Rico to finalize the last leg of the show. I don't know if I will remain here. My residency will be here until next summer, 2019. What I can tell you is, you know, being a little closer to Puerto Rico is really helpful. I'm thinking of bringing my mother over to spend a few weeks with us very soon. Chicago was very important, you know, for us to be able to pick up, you know, Florida. The problem I see here is that there's a little bit of distance from any the sensibility, you know, about the process that we went through. You know, a lot of comments of saying, oh, well, you know, we got hit by Irma, you know.
Right, and not understanding the difference between what you went through.
Yeah.
And so do you intend, I know it's a hard question to ask, but do you intend to stay in Florida or on the mainland?
You know, I cannot keep moving my children around and creating a sort of like real displacement, not only mentally, but physically, you know. So I'm really considering the possibility of staying here. And in many senses, all the friends that I met in Chicago, they have a winter place that they can go to and visit us. And we feel like we're there with them. So
right.
I'm thinking maybe probably staying here, yeah, for a little while.
Well, Richard, I want to thank you for sharing your story with us, for taking the time. Richard Santiago fled Puerto Rico for Chicago, as we've been talking about. He now lives in Florida. Cristina Pasiones Zayas is a co-chair of the Puerto Rican Agenda. As we have heard from her throughout the year, the relief efforts continue for Puerto Rico a year later. Cristina, as you said, you're still doing fundraising.
Yes, we have a GoFundMe campaign. You can just look up 3Rs for PR or visit us on our website, PuertoRicanChicago.org. And Richard, it's great to hear your voice. We miss you over here.
I miss you a lot too, Cristina. It's amazing to hear you. And thank you for everything.
Well, I'm glad that we were able to reunite you, at least on the airwaves, for a few minutes. Cristina, Richard, thank you for being with me. I appreciate it.
You take it easy. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Jewish people around the world are gathering tonight and tomorrow for their holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur. It's known as the Day of Atonement. And today we wanted to think about atonement not just for Jewish people, but for America as a country and when it comes to race. Not just today in 2018, but what people might have been thinking about during Yom Kippur 55 years ago in 1963 during the height of the Civil Rights Movement. A clue to this comes from Abraham Joshua Heschel, a Jewish-American rabbi, scholar, and philosopher who was very active in the Civil Rights Movement. In 1963, he gave a speech called Religion and Race, where he met Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He ended up marching from Selma to Montgomery with him. And in that speech, you can tell he deeply connected the plight of the Jewish people with that of African Americans in this country and the need for all Americans to repent. Joining me to talk more about this is Professor Brett Ashley Kaplan. She's the director of the Initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies at the University of Illinois. Rabbi Ari Neve is also with us, a senior Jewish educator at the University of Illinois' Hillel. Professor Kaplan, Rabbi Ari, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
And I know this is a really busy time of year for you, so thank you for making the time. Rabbi Ari, so for Jewish people are in this very holy period between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, in which this is Yom Kippur is supposed to be a time of asking for forgiveness and thinking about the ways you want to do better in the new year, which was Rosh Hashanah. And I think it's always easy to think about how we can do this on an individual level. Maybe it's not easy to do, but it's certainly easy to think about. What about collective wrongs? How does Judaism treat that?
So that's a great question. And firstly, just a quick fangirl moment. Any opportunity for me to either listen to or talk about Abraham Joshua Heschel is a great one for me. He's basically a rabbinic superhero for me. And he's like the rabbi that I want to be when I grow up. So I think the best way for me to understand the idea of kind of collective forgiveness is to think about specifically the term that's used a lot now in this time of the season that's called tshuva, right? Which is a difficult word to say in Hebrew and an even more difficult concept to understand. Essentially, it comes from the Hebrew word lashuv, to return. And it actually draws upon this idea that we are kind of returning to this idea of being better, really. And I think what comes to my mind when I think about this initially is Ta-Nehisi Coates' article from The Atlantic a number of years ago on the idea of reparations, right? It's called The Case for Reparations. And so he, in that very expansive article, he discusses this idea that reparations are this idea of essentially a collective societal tshuva process, that we as a society need to go through this process of reckoning together as a collective in order to truly understand who we are and how we've done wrong by the African-American community in it's truly systemic and institutional ways. And it's not an easy process. And it's a very challenging and thought-provoking process, but it needs to be done. And so I think that's, to me, the most apt understanding, especially in this context, of this kind of collective forgiveness. It's a collective reckoning. It's how we as a society look backwards at what we've done in years past as a collective, in order to learn from that whole history to do better for the years to come.
And this is a theme that I think a lot of rabbinical scholars bring up this time of year, especially when it comes to America and racism. Professor Kaplan, I wonder if you can explain us a little bit more about Abraham Joshua Heschel. He was born in Poland, but became prominent in the U.S. and in the civil rights movement.
Yes, indeed. He was born in Poland, and then he went to study in Germany, and then he moved to the U.S. because he moved to Germany in 1937, which is the worst time to become a professor in Germany. So he was exiled to the U.S. He first went from 1940 to 1945 to the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati.
That's where I went to school, too.
Ah, wonderful. You see, your rabbinic superhero was there. and then he went to New York, and he stayed there at the Jewish Theological Seminary until he died in 1972. He was born in 1907. Heschel believed in moving from self-centeredness to God-centeredness as a way of becoming an ethical person. At one point, he argued that, and I'm quoting him, the greatest beauty grows at the greatest distance from the ego. He tirelessly argued for an ethical approach to others, and he galvanized many people to action by grounding political activism in this theological argument about shifting the center of gravity towards God and away from the self.
We actually have some, yeah, so we actually have some audio of him. This is a 1963 speech on religion and race. He gave it in Chicago at a conference of the same name. Can we play a little bit of that?
At the first conference on religion and race, the main participants were Pharaoh and Moses. Moses... And Moses' words were, thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go. While Pharaoh retorted, who is the Lord that I should heed his voice and let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, I will not let Israel go. The outcome of that summit meeting has not come to an end. If Pharaoh is not ready to capitulate, the Exodus began, but is far from having been completed. In fact, it was easier for the children of Israel to cross the Red Sea than for a Negro to cross certain university campuses.
That's Abraham Joshua Heschel in 1963, actually in Chicago. Rabbi Ari, as you think about that, I wonder if that's a good explanation, you think, of the context of Jewish people working alongside a lot of African Americans in the civil rights movement.
So I think it's twofold. I think that definitely underscores our relationship is this idea that we have within our collective traditional history, this context of slavery. And I think it what comes from that as well is this idea that we understand oppression. We understand being othered. We understand what it's like to not be allowed into general society in a number of contexts. And I think what that serves to do is give us an understanding of why it's important to be in solidarity with African-American communities. It doesn't give us the same understanding of their oppression, but it gives us the imperative to listen to them.
Mm. And when, Professor Kaplan, when we think about Heschel's experience, as you mentioned, during the Holocaust, his personal experience, I wonder how much you think that changed his involvement as well on a personal level with all of these things.
Absolutely. I mean, Heschel's whole life was upended by the Holocaust. Members of his family were murdered, his community was destroyed, and he had to relocate to the U.S. in order to survive. He saw firsthand what both hatred and indifference could create, genocide. He and many of the other Jews who joined the civil rights movement were compelled to speak out and act out against oppression because of what they or their parents or relatives had experienced during the war. So there's a direct line between the Holocaust and many Jewish activists' reasons for speaking out.
And right, so that's the 60s. I wonder, when we think about the context of today, how do you think that relates to when we're thinking about America 2018?
Yeah, so I have been so impressed and emboldened by so many rabbis who are activists. So after Trump announced the travel ban, a group of rabbis, about 20 rabbis, were arrested in New York. And I just would like to read what one of them said. Rabbi Jill Jacobs said, "We remember our history, and we remember that the borders of this country closed to us in 1924 with very catastrophic consequences during the Holocaust. We know that some of the language that's being used now to stop Muslims from coming in is the same language that was used to stop Jewish refugees from coming." So just like there was a direct line between the Holocaust and many civil rights activists, there's a direct line now between the Holocaust and the recognition of this injustice spurring activists, rabbis and non-rabbis, to action now.
And Rabbi Arye, I wonder how much you're having these conversations with students on campus. That's your community, your faith community that you are working with.
These questions are come up all the time in conversation. I think it's an understanding of how can our community interact with and kind of stand in solidarity with other communities on campus, other cultural groups, other faith groups. And I think it's something that I definitely stress within my own rabbinate. You know, we're actually in the process of working on a variety of interfaith programming so that students understand how we as a Jewish community use our voice, our narrative, our history, as Professor Kaplan said, you know, what is it about our history that spurs us not just to discuss it, but to action and to stand in solidarity with communities that are currently in need?
And what do you think the significance of this is when you put this in the context of Yom Kippur?
So, I think it comes back to this idea of tshuva. Tshuva is reckoning, right? It's understanding who we've been, whether it's individually, whether it's communally, whether it's societally, in order to work towards becoming better for the years to come, right? One of our greatest philosophers and thinkers, the Rabbi Maimonides, basically said that the idea of tshuva is only half accomplished if all you do is sit and ponder what you've done in the year past. If it doesn't come with actual action and the thought process to really think through how you're going to avoid those behaviors and those actions from the years past, then it's only half accomplished. And I think this comes back to your question about collective reckoning and understanding how we kind of see this holiday from a collective perspective. If we as a society don't understand who we are or who we've been in the past, and we don't act towards changing that for the future, then it's only half accomplished.
And to that mind, is that how you, because I think it's really hard to think about how you atone for collective racial injustices.
It's incredibly challenging.
I think everyone thinks that. Like, how can one person change this?
Well, absolutely. And I think it's understanding the systemic nature of racism in the sense that it's not about one person being racist or like one person having done wrong, right? One of the main components of liturgy within the Yom Kippur service is that if you sit during prayer in the synagogue or in our really beautiful Hillel building on East John Street across from Insomnia Cookies, shout out to Hillel. But if that's where you are for the day and that's all you're doing, then and you're kind of atoning to God, then you haven't fulfilled the kind of responsibilities of Yom Kippur at all.
Yeah, from my perspective, I'm a secular person. It doesn't seem to me like the question is really about atonement, but it's more like how can we make things better and what can we do moving forward in the future to make things better, right?
And to do that on an individual level that will have a collective difference.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, well, thank you both for being with me. I really appreciate it. Brett Ashley Kaplan is the director of the Initiative in Holocaust, Genocide, and Memory Studies. She's also a professor of comparative literature, correct, at the U of I. Rabbi Arye Neveh, a senior Jewish educator as well at University of Illinois Hillel. Thank you for being with me. I really appreciate it, both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. If you have the NPR One app, by the way, you can download that from wherever you get your smartphone apps, and you can always find past shows there. It's pretty simple. If you download it, you can set your home station to however you listen to the 21st. And if you search for the 21st to follow us, it's an easy way to listen to past shows. We're also available wherever you get your podcasts. Our Twitter handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. on Facebook. If you look for the 21st to Like Us, that's another way to comment on what we're working on. You can also post questions or comments you'd like us to ask on air. All those links, every other way to contact us. All you have to remember is our website, 21stshow.org. That's where we've got past shows. That's where we've got our social media handles. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, just go to 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Morg. Thanks to Christine Herman for helping out with us today. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.